Hi, this is Tim Lightfoot, the director of the Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance, and we're really excited to tell you about an event coming up. We hope that you're close enough or you're near one of our satellite sites to see it, and that's the Huffines Discussion 2013. And this is the one where we bring in guest speakers from all over the world that are going to tell us their big ideas about the role and the future of sports medicine and human performance. And so join us November the 15th, 2013, from 1 to 4 p.m. here on site at Texas A&M at the Annenberg Presidential Conference Center. You can also go on our website at huffinesinstitute.org, go over to the news and pull down to where it says Huffines Discussion, and you can find a list of all our satellite sites around the country that will be simulcasting the event at the same time. So join us on November 15th, 2013, for the Extraordinary Huffines Discussion 3.
Welcome to the Sports Medicine Podcast, brought to you by the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology at Texas A&M University. At the Huffines Institute, we're always working to facilitate, apply, and bring you the most up-to-date coverage of the wide world that is sports medicine and human performance, all in a language you can understand and share with your friends. And now, here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Well, hello and welcome to the weekly podcast from the Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance. I'm your host, Tim Lightfoot, and we're so glad that you took the time to download us and that you're taking the time to listen. Every week we bring you an interesting individual in the world of sports medicine and human performance, and today is no exception. We are quite pleased and honored to have Dr. John Chong with us. Welcome to the podcast, John.
Hey, hi everybody.
I'm going to take just a minute and tell everybody why we've got you on. We are so excited, like I said, to have Dr. Chong on. And he is the current medical director of the Musicians Clinics of Canada. He was a founding member and is now the president of the Performing Arts Medicine Association. He is the medical director and teacher of performance awareness at the Glenn Gould School and the Royal Conservatory of Music in Toronto. He is also the medical consultant for the National Youth Orchestra of Canada. And so you can tell from what we've talked about that he's a physician that specializes in musicians' illnesses and injuries. And so we've got Dr. Chong on today, continuing our Athletes in the Arts initiative, where we're talking about how sports medicine relates to the world of performing arts. And so anyway, we're glad to have you on, John. Thanks for taking some time out of your busy schedule to be with us today.
It's an extreme pleasure and honor.
Well, thank you. So let's just kind of start off with how did you get involved with this? You have a fascinating story as to your background and why you were involved in treating musicians.
To make a long story short, I am a musician, was a musician, trained at the conservatory, so-called prodigy lifestyle, practicing 6 hours a day. I got injured when I was 14 and kind of made all the mistakes in the world, which I can speak about with authority, and then went into composition, electronic music, and then for some strange irony, of course, the family said, you have to go to medical school, which is fairly stereotypical Asian, Canadian stuff. So, of course, obedient kid as I am not, I went to medical school. Somehow I got in. That's the other issue. And then floundered my way through life, which I still am, and stumbled upon integrating all the kind of areas of interest, which would be music first, electrical engineering, and, of course, medicine.
Yeah.
So postgraduate training was interesting because I already had no idea what the hell I was doing or wanted to do. So I sort of fumbled around in various areas of postgrad and dreamt about this and dreamt about that. And suddenly I thought about occupational medicine, disease of the worker, since we ran a laundry and I sort of had a reaction to anesthetic gases and all kinds of silly things like that, long stories. I said, wow, this is really interesting. So I got into the diseases of occupations and then said, hey, this is really weird. It's right in front of my nose. Why don't I get involved in my own home community, performing arts? So that's how I joined PAMA right from the day one with Alice Brantford Benner and Dick Letterman, who are just wonderful mentors and brought the whole organization along for the last 30 or so years. And here we are. So that's sort of the history in a nutshell. Yes, various strange tangents along the way.
Well, what's fascinating about that is I think that so many medical practitioners in particular, if they had, I think if they had the experiences that you had, and you know, you grew up in the field, so you know the ins and the outs of the performing arts, and so you can really bring that experience to your medical practice.
Absolutely. I've done it all, so to speak, right? So.
Yeah. Now, you know, you mentioned something there in telling us about your background that you talked about is fairly stereotypical in musicians, and that's a lot of practice a day. I'm not sure people realize that even young musicians are practicing just quite extraordinary lengths of time during the day.
Yeah, well, that's the sort of culture of performing arts education, which, of course, in PAMA we're confronting fairly systematically. So, you know, if you grow up, you love to play, and you love Beethoven or Chopin, your teacher's all enthusiastic, and by the way, you get rewarded for it by competitions and get patted on the head and everybody loves you, well, there's no reason to stop. So. So the body said, I think you better stop, by getting pain signals and bumps and things like that. So usually, you know, I learn the hard way, and of course all my patients learn the hard way when the body says no, and geez, what happened? So I guess that's our charge and our job, both in PAMA as well as athletes in the arts. What does it mean when the body gives you signals and says, hey, hold the phone there, guys, you know.
Right.
Something's gone. There's a malfunction here.
Right.
We better pay attention. So that's the sort of springboard in which we want to get to what's going wrong, what is this all about, and, of course, prevention is the name of the game, prevention education.
Now, I would think so many of the lay public out there in hearing this would think, wow, you know, playing an instrument really is not that stressful, so how can it injure somebody if they're playing for 6 and 7 and 8 hours a day?
Yeah, well, that's the key thing. So what is actually going on?
Yeah.
6 or 7 hours a day times 6, 7, well, pretty well every day. So, you know, my students in the Glenn Gould, you know, we started out, we're dealing with postgrads this year, and I said, well, just, you know, how much time do you spend practicing? And of course, it has to be at least 6 hours.
Wow.
Every day. So you're looking, you know, at a normal 40 to 50 hour practice week.
Wow.
I said, well, what do you do in that time? Well, I hang out in the studio and I practice. I said, well, that's interesting. And what do you practice? Well, what I'm working on. Duh. And I said, well, how do you practice that? Over and over and over and do this, and my teacher helps me out, and I get a lesson, and I have all these notes in my head that this is no good and this is terrible, and it goes on, and then I said, well, how do you know it's, like, really bad or you should work on that, and how do you know that it's good enough? You don't have a score like in sports, right? So if you play golf, of course you practice, and you know, when you take it to the course, you sort of know whether you made the cut or not, or whether you're holding the trophy and earn $10 million. But in the arts, it's totally different. You're sort of beholden to your own stories about yourself. So it's a lot of time to spend by yourself and telling yourself and echoing what you might or might not be real about what's going on. And, of course, it's never good enough.
Right.
With any endeavor, sports or art.
Yeah, because as musicians in particular, you tend to focus on the things you got wrong.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
And that's what you're told as well, not if you got right. You
know,
out of 10,000 notes, oh, geez, you made 3 bloops.
Yeah.
By the way, you know, by the way, don't ever show up again unless you get it right next week or else.
Wow.
And that's the tradition, especially in classical musical training. But, you know, that's the culture we live in, and that's why the injury rates are so high.
Is there a bias against musicians who report injuries?
Oh, it depends what sector you're in, right?
Mm.
So let's start with sports, you know, athletes in arts. Well, you know, I watch TSN all the time. I watch hockey, I watch football, and, you know, it's a kind of, oh, who's on the injury list and who's getting this surgery, and oh my God, he's out with a concussion. And there's a little of a kind of badge of honor.
Mm-hmm.
And he did return, he played a great game, and he threw 4 touchdowns even though he can't walk straight.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of it's completely the opposite. It's a don't ask, don't tell kind of cloister of secrecy around injuries. Why? Well, I think there's a culture within the performing artists that they don't want anybody to know. There's a definite occupational or educational Darwinism.
Mm.
Show any weakness, you might perceive that you may not, you know, do well, or people might think you're weird or something, and of course, you might actually lose your job.
Right.
if you are a freelance type position, which most musicians are, they don't have full-time appointments. If you're a performer, you are actually vulnerable to rumor and innuendo that, you know, that because you're injured, you're probably not that good and, you know, you're something wrong with you. And, of course, you may not be able to perform up to your high standards because of some reason. So, that, you know, there's many, many factors within the education and occupational system which sort of plays against the glory of being hurt and wearing the badge of pain.
Yeah. And does that, do those issues prevent musicians from coming forward or coming to your clinic to
get
help?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
I started this way back in the 80s, and, you know, I was just used to dealing with injured workers, with, you know, repetitive strain injuries and you know, various poisoning, lead, and lung diseases, all the normal stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But what I was shocked about when I started seeing consultation requests about musicians, these guys were having issues, medical problems that were, you know, and over the last 10 or so years, I'm going, well, wait a second here. What do you mean you've had this problem for 10 years and you haven't seen anybody?
Wow.
All, you know, the story unfolds. First of all, you know, we didn't have anybody to see who kind of gets it. Well, that sort of felt good, but that didn't really help because, you know, the problem was very, very deep set and chronic. And often the problems are not just, you know, pain and soreness for 10 years. It's a movement disorder. So initially the cases that I saw were extremely, extremely serious.
Mm.
And, you know, these people had lost their careers. They're depressed. You know, they weren't functioning because of their work dependent on their ability to perform, whether teaching or performing. So they're really in dire straits. And there was no compensation, there's no rehab, there's no nothing. They were just, you know, hiding in obscurity.
Well, it's interesting that you brought up a point there that, you know, subsequent to the physical injury comes the mental problems that comes along with that as well.
Well, it's both. It's all part of the same process, as we know neurobiologically. We know, even epidemiologically, the recent study by Bronwyn Ackerman out of Sydney, Australia, had looked now at presenting musculoskeletal pain as well as anxiety and depression all in one little package and seen the connection and correlation. The more severe the anxiety and depression, of course, the more severe musculoskeletal pain. So this just published about a month ago, which is, I think, you know, quite landmarkish, so to speak. So now we're actually seeing it in big EEP as well as from a theoretical pathophysiological point of view. So it's all coming together now.
Yeah. Well, the picture's becoming clear and public, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I think in the old days, we sort of moaned about, you know, the depression and addiction, and then another guy dies, and Jim Morrison died, and Amy Winehouse died, and Corey Monteith died, et cetera, et cetera, and some survive rarely, like Eric Clapton, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the time, it's tragedy, and there's sort of a celebrity kind of feel. Oh, my God, you know.
Yeah.
Too bad, but it's the addict and the nature of the beast in your personality or your genetics even, you know. So, but I think that's so antiquated and not really evidence-based. You got to sort of look at what's going on in education and the workplace, and then you can sort of see that, hey, this is really no different than other medical problems in any other industry.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some good things about this industry and obviously some issues that are huge risk factors.
Yeah.
There's illness and injury.
Well, and these injuries can occur, and they're not uncommon. I know offline, before we started here, you and I are chatting a little bit about your daily workload as a physician in your clinic.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you've got a packed schedule every day.
Yeah. Well, I'm Sandy, the boss at the clinic just said, well, by the way, you're full till the end of the year, and we're booking 2014, so I'm going, wait a second here. You know, hello, we just passed Canadian Thanksgiving here and have an open slot, so what about the emergency? So we just had that debate. Well, I've kept a few spots there, but i.e., don't you dare disappear and go play hockey or the golf course.
Golf.
But I do have a speaking schedule, so I'm like, oh, boy.
Yeah.
So it's a nice business problem to have.
Yeah.
I probably should rub in, you know, we do have a healthcare system that's publicly funded in Canada, which I think is a huge advantage to the performing artist as well as athletes.
Mm.
There's no barrier to access. and I know in the States, in other jurisdictions, it's very difficult to even get an opinion or some help, regardless of any, you know, specialization or interest in the field.
Yeah. Well, and that's what I was going to ask about. I know you specialize in musicians. Are there other clinics like yours that you know of in Canada or around the States that or even in worldwide that specialize in musicians' medical issues?
Well, I think the circumstances are lucky because of the Canadian healthcare system. So I do have flexibility within reason within the provincial health plans, actually, as a specialist, pick and choose what and who I want to see. So that is not true in an insurance-driven system like in the States. So even if you had universal insurance access, you'd still be under those controls.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's number one. And then, of course, the secondary issue, who you're going to see and what background do they have. So, you know, this is a huge problem when it comes to care performing artists. I think what Pam is trying to tackle in terms of education and other issues such as access and funding we can't control. Regardless of that challenge, I mean, there's been an incredible dedication from, say, Richard Letterman and Alice Brenner, you know, over the years. They have seen musicians, you know, often for no payment or off on the side, slipped in between, you know, all their the normal day-to-day work as a neurologist or physical medicine specialist. And others have tried very, very much so, and for example, in dance medicine. And I've done that as an orthopedic surgeon. So we do it because we love to do it. In my case, it's kind of lucky. I love to do it and also can cobble out a living and support staff, and, which I think is fairly unique. Other jurisdictions are academically based, like in Australia. Or in Europe, where you know they have special circumstances, where the arts are, you know, like football and hockey in North America, were up there. So they take special interest in their artists. So therefore, it's less of a challenge from the healthcare provider point of view to make a case to say I want to spend time and look at these things and research these things. So again, Eckhard Altenmuller in Germany and others have you know, been able, because of their local circumstances, been able to really to accelerate their growth clinically as well as on the research side. So.
Well, and given your circumstances, it allows you to be a really good observer as to probably what are the most common injuries in musicians. And so that begs a natural question. Are there common injuries you see in musicians, and are there any particular musicians that you see more often than others?
Well, it's a two-stage question.
Sure.
Or what are the sort of common things? Well, I have an acronym, which is called MADNESS. It's muscle fatigue for M, A for anxiety, D for depression, N, E for nerve entrapment, and SS for stress syndrome. So it's madness. And it's not one or the other, so that's another unique issue. As an occupational physician, I can sort of look at all aspects related to the whole person, as opposed to just looking at nerve entrapments or muscle issues or the psychiatric aspects. And then have a very integrated approach across, you know, all the various items. And I guess the challenge has been how the hell do all these MADNESS relate? And the current science is quite remarkable in leading to, you know, a mechanism and as well, you know, observable populations with the same issues. So you know, it is very much related to neurobiologically what stress is perceived by the individual. Obvious is performance anxiety. Obvious, if you're not up to snuff, you get somewhat down on yourself, depressed. And the pain is about your autonomic nervous system, you know, switching on and saying, uh-oh, I'm in danger, or I'm pissed off, I'm angry, or I better freeze here because somebody's going to whack me over the head, in simple terms. And that fires out in a fairly standard chronic stress response with cortisol firing from your parts of your brain to stimulate the adrenals, and out floods cortisol, which activates muscle tension, pain sensors in your muscles, as well as, you know, does other nasty things around the body, like shorten your telomeres and wreck your immune system.
Mm-hmm.
All those other
shorten your life.
Minor little things like that. And then, you know, eventually something goes haywire in your stress regulation system. So I can remember this very simply in, you know, two famous songs, What Goes Up Must Come Down.
Mm-hmm.
I think we all got to go around blood, sweat, and tears. That's normal, as described by Salyer way back in the good old McGill days of homeostasis.
Mm-hmm.
But if you remember the old up, up, and away, that's what happens when the system loses its ability to downregulate. So basically, you got a stress system that's a runaway train.
Yeah, it just keeps going on and on.
Going and going. It literally has a mind of its own. So
yeah.
Regardless of what you do, it's about, you know, how you're trained, and those factors are wired, literally hardwired into your system.
Yeah.
So, and then you run into big troubles, heart disease, cancer, and all the other horrible diseases that are now clearly related to shortened telomeres and stress. So again, that's all fairly recent stuff, 2009 Nobel Prize, and you know all the glory years of brain imaging in the last 10, 15 years,
mm-hmm.
that we've been able to study clinically and on a population basis. So it all fits now, but it starts with, you know, being at the bedside and taking a good history.
Yeah. If you have young musicians, and we have young folks that listen to this, and some of them play instruments, and are there general kind of things that they can do to help prevent them from dropping into this whole madness syndrome?
Yeah, well, just remember the acronym MADNESS.
Yeah.
If you start losing it, you know, consciousness of what you're trying to do, say as a performing artist,
mm-hmm.
we'd usually do it for the right reasons, i.e. we love it and we're actually good at it.
Mm-hmm.
Then, you know, we're subject to other influences. And we might start doing it and not listening to our bodies about, you know, for possibly not very healthy reasons, very stressful reasons.
Right.
Or getting somewhere and being competitive as opposed to just loving to do it.
Right.
Doing it for adoration, narcissism, rather than just loving to do it. Or actually believing you can make a living doing it. So, you know, it's important to actually look at reality here.
Yeah.
It's nice that people adore you and love you. That's a given. That should be that way. Not because of what you do. It's who you are. And that's the way biology should be. Now, in terms of work, you know, it's a bit spine-chilling, and everybody in sports knows not everybody can be on the PGA Tour. Not everybody can win $10 million in one tournament at the FedEx Cup.
Right.
And not everybody can win the Stanley Cup, let alone make the NHL. So that's been worked out. So basically the odds of being a talented Johnny playing piano, being adored by beautiful nannies, which is me, and winning a few competitions, the chances of actually making it big time to be a Lang Lang or a Tiger Woods is about, you know, 1.5 million.
Right, right.
And it's getting worse because of the economic circumstance.
Mm-hmm. And more people.
And more people.
Yeah.
And, you know, dilution and the effect of, you know, multimedia, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it goes on and on. But, you know, it's not unlike sports. I mean, you know, you do it because you love it. You play golf, you play hockey, you play football because you love to play.
Yeah.
You always have a dream. There's nothing wrong with that. But to actually believe that and actually hurt yourself in pursuit of that, well, then we know a lot from sports medicine, sports psychology, that, you know, better take it easy on those concussions, you know.
Right.
Better take it easy on those knees, because, you know, eventually it ain't going to happen.
Right. You'll need them to get around the rest of your life,
I think.
Yeah.
Need a brain, so we know all that.
Yeah.
All concussion stuff recently. It's like, wow.
Yeah.
So, you know, but it's not really any different. I guess what the distinguishing factor is, okay, but, you know, playing piano is not football. But if you actually look at some of the brain imaging data and the stress that the individual is under, well, you know, the physical trauma is actually equal psychological trauma.
Hmm.
It's like, what? How's that possible? So that research has been done. So you can reject somebody quite severely and abusively, so the so-called targeted humiliating criticism.
I had that phrase on my question list, so I'm glad you bring that up.
Versus actually getting smacked in the head, going through off tackle.
Yeah.
Brain scans are exactly the same. You know, areas light up in the brain which are not good places to light up.
So what? How do you define targeted humiliating criticism?
Well, this is actually the work of UCLA researchers, Slavich and group. And what they did was a series of psychological experiments with the endpoint of being stuck in a brain scanner. So it's fairly artificial. You just get kicked out of the video game like musical chairs.
Mm-hmm.
They give you $20 and then you fill out all your questionnaires and then you get stuck in the brain scanner. And ironically, everybody knows it's fake and lights up your brain in the anterior cingulate cortex, sort of worry center, the hub of the mind, and of course in your insula, which is where the body maps live, so equal physical pain. It's like, what? These kids know that it's completely fake, yet there's something about rejection that just lights it up. Now, in real life, they've, of course, pursued that thread and said, well, what is actually the risk here? So if you actually get rejected by someone else, i.e. dumped or flunk an audition, you're done. The risk to your health is about 22 times. So that's the same risk public health-wise as asbestos and tobacco. So it's like, what? How is that possible? Well, they got all the data there to look at that. And then if you just, say you reject somebody or you lose somebody, say, from health, that's about 10 times risk of getting unwell. So that's like, what? How is that possible? Well, that's what the data shows. Now we can elucidate some of the mechanisms because of the stress response now. So now they actually measure all the inflammatory byproducts of the cortisol, you know, flooding the body. So now we can sort of clinically work it out in real time and say, oh, I get it now. So this is really not good for you, whether you get smacked in the head or you get smacked in the head.
Yeah, so, with criticism.
Yeah. So that's the most potent targeted humiliating criticism, which, of course, you can expect is pretty endemic in, performing arts education, whether in dance or music.
Yeah, we were talking to a professor recently who was a professor at a music school, and he said, yeah, it's not uncommon for, especially during auditions, for a conductor to walk down their line and go, look at someone and say, nope, 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 maybe, nope, nope, yes, kind of thing.
Yeah. So, ironically, you know, if you're in boot camp and, you know, the sergeant major walked down, you're hoping to say, no, you're out.
Yeah.
You can join the band or something.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, it's the complete opposite. If you're a performing artist, a dancer, a musician, your whole life depends on being picked.
Yeah.
Right? And if you're not, you're the unlucky, whatever, 9 out of 10, you're done. You know, you're off to, as I would say, teach Suzuki piano and St. Marie or whatever, smooth rock fall.
Yeah, whatever comes next.
Wherever, you know, if you're lucky, you can cobble out a living. Otherwise, you know, you'll be performing around the world on, you know, recording contracts and living in 5-star hotels and be the talk of the town. Unfortunately, that's the way it is.
Yeah.
And that's not going to change in terms of the business and competitiveness. That's showbiz.
Yeah, yeah. Well, John, thank you. I'm getting the sign here that we are running out of time. I really want to thank you for your time today and fascinating background. I only got to about 4 of my questions, which was great. We always give our guests an opportunity to tell our listening audience, give our listening audience a take-home message.
Yeah.
What would be your take-home message for today?
Well, I think it's about performance awareness and learning about listening to your body. And there are some amazing techniques we now have, and we obviously use them in sports, basically biofeedback. So we can listen to your muscles using muscle EMG biofeedback. If you have access to something, you can definitely look at your heart rate variability.
We can do that, yes.
You sure can with, you know, very cheap programs and even on your iPhone.
Yeah.
You can really learn about your own response and how your body's functioning when you might be getting into trouble rather than waiting till you can't function or you're so crippled that you're done. So we have the technology now, and it's just a matter of putting it in place, you know, from an educational point of view. So I sort of challenge the listeners saying, what are the ways that I can be more in tune with myself, you know, as I'm practicing, as I'm competing, not just to win, but to prevent any injury or illness. So that's a long term, but also very reachable goal, I think, PAMA has.
Right. We just want to keep them healthy, huh?
Yeah, exactly. So it's different than sports. I mean, once you're on the injury line, you're done. I mean, you're not contributing to the team or yourself.
Yeah, yeah. Well, great take-home message. Thanks so much for being with us today, John.
Hey, Tim. Great.
Yeah. And for the listeners, thank you so much for being with us today. Regular listeners will know that this is the time in the podcast when we have our podcast question of the week. And here with our question of the week is our producer, Kelly.
What is the meaning of the acronym MADNESS?
Great question. Be the first person to email us the correct answer to the question at huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu, and you'll win one of those nifty podcast t-shirts. We have our third editions, and they look really great. So, you know, send us that email. Let us know. In the meantime, we hope that you all take the time to come back and join us again next week for another great guest like we had this week. And until next week, we hope you stay active and healthy.
Thanks for listening to the Huffines Institute Weekly Sports Medicine Podcast. This podcast was produced by Cheryl Marek and Kelly Selman and made possible by generous support from the Omar Smith family and the Sydney and J.L. Huffines family. This podcast is published under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. That means you can't sell it or change it, but feel free to give it to everyone you know and to talk and blog about us. And in case you were wondering, our openings and closing are provided by johnmilesproductions.com, and our music was provided by Dave Zeltner. Find him on the web at davidzeltner.com. And just so you know, we love hearing from you. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.